Hello, you are listening to podcast number 2 for the lecture introduction of the Artificial Intelligence course. We resume on slide 16. So from the previous discussion, we've seen that there are quite some different approaches to the study of artificial intelligence. And we've seen two fundamental lines of research. We can either try to make computers more intelligent, just by focusing on the machine and how it could achieve this behavior, or we can also focus on better understanding human intelligence. And we've also seen that AI covers the perception that we are able to receive information from the environment. It covers cognition, what we do with these percepts to arrive at decisions, and it covers acting. And now this also means we can focus on more the cognition side or more on the action side of an intelligent system. So this means we end up with four different approaches. So do we more focus about the thinking or the acting? And do we more look towards a human model with all the defects it has, or a normative rational model? On slide 17, I summarized some selected definitions from the field, and I don't want to go into detail too much here, but it is important to note that different researchers tend to adopt different positions here with respect to their work in AI. So don't be surprised if you hear different people talking about artificial intelligence, that they present and describe quite different understandings. So the field is very diverse, and some of the very definitions and ideas about AI are listed on the slide, and you see that this has been for many decades like this. And whether we more focus on thinking humanly or thinking rationally, our definition of the focus for the field is quite different. I recommend here to read the book in detail because it discusses all these positions and gives you more examples. So let's briefly summarize again what these four different positions involve. So if we focus on thinking humanly, then of course we want to understand the cognitive capabilities of humans. So what is necessary to produce intelligent performance? It is not so important here to be able to solve problems correctly, but it is important to solve problems exactly like a human would do. Of course, this approach underlies fields such as psychology, brain research, cognitive science. We will not discuss the results from these research fields in this course. Acting humanly, and you see a slide, an example on slide 19, has also been in the focus of humans for a very long time. So humans have always been fascinated by machines that would act like humans. So already in the ancient Greek times, you can read about descriptions of mechanical systems that do certain things. Here we see an example from the 18th century, the Mechanical Turk, kind of robot that would be able to play chess. It turned out that this robot was operated by a small human who sits in the cabinet below the chessboard. And when people discovered this, they were actually quite upset about this so-called Turk. That's why you see this Mechanical Turk frame or phrase used also today. So date back to this example. Thinking rationally means that we focus on the laws of thought, and we think about formal systems that describe how one can think. This is a study of research that dates back to ancient Greek times in the old philosophical systems, systems of normative thinking were developed. We use certain computational laws today to derive conclusions and actually implement logical reasoning systems. And we will see those in the course, for example. Acting rationally is a focus for us when we develop rational agents. And we will study this in the next lecture in more depth. A rational agent acts so as to achieve its given goals. So it has some goals it wants to pursue, and it receives percepts from the environment, and it assumes that its percepts and impressions of the world are correct. And based on these correct perceptions, it implements some cognition procedure to then arrive at actions it will execute in the world as in reaction to the percepts it receives from the environment. Rational thinking is a prerequisite for rational acting, but it's not necessarily a necessary condition. So, for example, very quickly you arrive at the problem of how can you make a decision when you are faced with insufficient information. And we will definitely look at this concept of the rational agent in this course. And this is also the main metaphor underlying the textbook that we use. In fact, the textbook by Russell and Novick is also called the Rational Agent Book. Let's come back to Alan Turing's famous paper that asked these questions of whether machines can think. On slide 22, I show a few citations from this paper. And in this paper, Turing also, of course, explores how we can test whether a system is intelligent or not, and he introduces an imitation game that we know today under the name of the Turing test. Originally, in the text, he describes it as a game that is played with three people. We have a man, and we have a woman, and we have an interrogator. And the interrogator is in a separate room, so he cannot see the man and the woman, and they all three together hold a conversation, and the goal of this game for the interrogator is to find out who is the man and who is the woman. So the goal of the man in this game is to try to convince the interrogator that he is the woman, whereas the goal of the woman is to help the interrogator that he can arrive at the right identification of the two people. So this may seem to be a little surprising that Turing focuses on the difference between a man and a woman here, but we also have to see this in the light of the historic circumstances. Turing really suffered through heavy prosecution due to his homosexuality, and somehow being somebody he can't be and he doesn't want to be, and imitating another person had been a serious challenge for him. So this somehow is also reflected in this test. So historians actually discussed quite intensively the personal situation of Turing that led him to define this test in this paper. Today, many AI researchers reject this test. They believe it is not appropriate to really judge the intelligence of an intelligent system. Nevertheless, the test lives on. There's, for example, the so-called Loebner competition, which actually implements exactly this test. Interestingly, Turing then moves on and asks exactly for this exchange. So he says, we take the man and we now let a machine take this part. And when you read the last sentence, he then formulates it as, the new problem has the advantage of drawing a fairly sharp line between the physical and the intellectual capacities of a man. So in the English language, man can stand for male persons, but it can also stand for human persons. So the paper is not really clear here if the computer is really to role the play of, or the role of the man, and the woman is the woman, and what really the game is in the end. Today we often interpret it as replacing a human with a computer and then being able to distinguish between a human and the computer. On slide 23, I put a video recommendation for you together, and There is a nice movie, I personally liked it a lot, which actually talks about the Turing test. So it explores the ultimate version of the test, and you can watch the trailer on YouTube, or if you have time, maybe you even want to watch the movie. The story in this movie is about the owner of an IT company. The owner has developed an AI in his research facility, and he selects an employee to actually run a Turing test. And he explains in this trailer the ultimate version of the test. And this is about knowing that we actually talk with a robot, and still we see no difference to a human. So we attribute consciousness to this robot. So the wall is gone. The interrogator sees the human and the robot, and the movie then explores how this test can actually get out of control. Let's look a little bit at the history of AI. On slide 25, I start describing the major phases. So we had an early phase in the 40s until the early 50s, so before this really landmark of the Dartmouth conference. And in this time, the studies of AI were always often also conducted under the headline of cybernetics. So cybernetics, in fact, could have been a different term for the field, but it did not work out this way. So the field was then called AI at the 56th Dartmouth conference. So there, of course, artificial intelligence was defined as a research program. There was a research community behind it, and it was mostly established as part of computer science, but of course also with linkages to many other fields which study the problem of intelligence. In the 50s until the 60s, we actually saw some early successes. So it was pretty amazing to see that there was a theorem prover that would prove mathematical theorems, something that many humans even can't do. Then there were the first game-playing programs that also were able to play games like chess, for example, at some reasonable level already. There were many attempts to formalize aspects of the world, and people studied intensively logic-based inference mechanisms. One of the main hypotheses underlying AI research is the so-called physical symbol system hypothesis. And this states that a physical symbol system has the necessary and sufficient means for general intelligent action. This is a direct response to the question that Alan Turing asked. So can computers think? A computer is a physical symbol system. And if a physical symbol system can think, then we can answer the question with yes. So this is a hypothesis that we don't really know if it's true. I think in the early days, researchers were quite confident that this is true. Today, it's more under question. And I think you have to decide for yourself if you believe it or not. The hypothesis states that a computer, and in fact just a piece of software, is able to be intelligent. Other positions that question this hypothesis, for example, state the necessity to have a body. So a body and the embodiment of a system is absolutely important to be intelligent and to have an intelligent interaction with our world. So we'll see if this hypothesis is true. We have currently, with AI research, try to find out by experimentation. In this time, in the 50s and 60s, many fundamental AI techniques were developed that we even continue to improve today. And in the lecture, we will also learn about some of these seminal algorithms that play an important role today in AI systems. Initially, these algorithms are always tested on simplifications of our world, and these simplifications have become known under the term of micro-worlds or so-called toy domains. And one big challenge for AI has always been that all the solutions work very well in these micro worlds, but then very often also scale to real worlds. So here we always have to be careful to understand the limitations of these micro worlds and then really be critical with our approaches and make sure that we can extend them to real world problems. On slide 27, you see some pictures from a very famous and fundamental project in robotics research. So one of the first robots that actually introduced many, many important concepts that we still use today was Shaky. Shaky the robot developed at Stanford University. You can today admire it in the Smithsonian Museum. Introduced, for example, a layered architecture for robot control as we find it today in the ROS operating system. It had cameras for sensing. The Shaky team pioneered fundamental image processing algorithms. And Shaky operated in a world which is called the blocks world. So Shaky had these blocks and pyramids of different shape and color. And the final goal of the project was that Shaky would be able to manipulate these blocks. Given the limited hardware at these times, this goal was never reached, but the symbolic representation of such a micro world, the blocks world, were developed, and they are still used today and in the sections by or in the lectures by Professor Hoffmann on automated planning, you will actually see this world again and how it is represented in a language called STRIPS that was developed for the Shaky robot. On slide 28, we see Herbert Simon. He was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics for his work on decision making. And here's a citation, and you see how optimistic researchers in those days were. So he said, I can say that there are now in the world machines that think, learn, and create. And today, when we look back, we would rather not accept this and consider this as real thinking, for example. And also in these days, people were very, very enthusiastic. And you see that here he claims that in a visible future, the range of problems these machines can handle will be coextensive with the range to which the human mind has been applied. So Herbert Simon and other research were a little too optimistic. And on slide 29, we see the first crisis that AI research encountered. So in the early 70s, it was pretty clear that all these promises are much, much harder to satisfy than people expected. So for example, attempts to make syntactic language translations led to very, very infamous failures. It turned out that many problems are much harder than they were expected, so it was not possible to simply exhaustively enumerate variants or explore very large state spaces. So the problem of combinatorial explosion was observed. And it turned then later out that many of these problems, in fact, are NP-hard or even harder. And one also began to slowly understand the limitations of many mechanisms. For example, we will later in this lecture learn about perceptrons. Perceptrons are very simple neural networks. They can learn everything they can represent, but they can only represent very little. So it took another decade or even several decades to further grow and develop these algorithms and mechanisms to really make them scale. Two interesting developments are shown on slide 30. So AI has always been a source of inspiration for many fields in computer science. So for example, it has also developed its own programming languages. We see functional programming in the Lisp language on the left side, and we see logical programming in the language Prolog on the right side. Both languages continue to live, but of course they have also been much more further developed. So for example, today Scala and Java offer interesting constructs of functional programming. We see logical programming, for example, in constraint languages that we will learn more about in this course. And AI has also motivated the development of object-oriented programming, because the need to somehow group information around objects and describe the worlds in terms of objects that interact with each other made it necessary to come up also with new constructs and programming languages. In the 70s and mid-80s, we saw a paradigm shift in AI. The first decades were mostly dominated by the development of formalisms and algorithms that would operate with very little knowledge. So there was a little background knowledge encoded in these formalisms, but it was not used extensively. So with this first crisis, then people actually asked themselves, don't we need to provide these systems with more background knowledge, similar to what humans know? So this was the phase of the famous expert systems that were developed. So human experts were interrogated. One also tried to learn knowledge from human experts and encode this knowledge into new representation formalisms. And we, in this lecture on knowledge representation, we will actually look into this more closely. But it will also be very important for all other concepts and algorithms that we teach in this lecture. So we can summarize this as a move from so-called weak methods in the sense that they don't have much background knowledge at their disposal, to so-called strong methods, which rely on very comprehensive domain models. But similar to the introductory example about the attempt to define a chair by giving some explicit description of its properties, these strong methods also very quickly encountered limitations. The systems started with some well-coded knowledge bases, but of course knowledge is subject to change. And then adding new knowledge suddenly led to various problems. For example, we had to revise the knowledge base because the new knowledge actually makes some of the old knowledge invalid. So this was another challenge that then came up with the development of knowledge-based systems. I also want to briefly mention that weak and strong methods are also used, or the terms weak and strong are also used in connection with more cognitive driven to more rationally driven approaches. So sometimes you also hear about strong AI in a sense of an AI system that replicates human intelligence, and a weak AI is a special purpose system that uses specific algorithms but does not draw much inspiration from human problem solving. In the 70s and 80s, we also saw the first AI technology companies rising. So on slide 32, we see an example of one of these expert systems. Meissen was very famous. It was developed to help physicians to choose the right antimicrobial therapy. And you see here a rule in Lisp, and it's English translation at the bottom, and you see fundamental concepts that you will also learn about later in this lecture. So first we have preconditions, premise of the premises that we actually look at, and we have then an action. So we conclude about some diagnosis, and this action has a confidence value. And today we actually see confidence values quite heavily used, for example, in machine learning systems. On slide 32, you see the key MISIN algorithms, how it works, and you see also its base architecture. So in this MISIN architecture, we see many elements that we need to implement in modern AI system architectures. So of course, we need a user interface to interact with the human. We have a knowledge base where we store the rules of the background knowledge that we use. The system receives current fact via the user interface. It has a so-called knowledge acquisition component that it can use to update the knowledge base. It has an inference engine to apply the rules and come to some conclusions. And of course, it has an explanation component. And the explanation of AI-based decisions has become a very urgent need over the last years with the wide application of machine learning components. On slide 34, I summarize again knowledge intensive versus knowledge sparse approaches, strong versus weak AI. So knowledge sparse are, for example, approaches where we use axioms, some facts, but very strong algorithms. For example, indexing used by Google, and then the PageRank algorithm to determine most promising web pages. The heuristic and stochastic search in the Deep Blue chess computer in those days was an example of a knowledge sparse approach, or the theorem proving done in the logic theorist program. Knowledge intensive or knowledge strong approaches are approaches where we use domain ontologies and large encoded bodies of knowledge. So for example, in the book of opening games in chess, or the rules used by expert systems such as MISIN, or if, for example, Google or other companies use user profiles where they collect information that they can find about us on the web. On slide 35, we see the toughest crisis of AI research. So in the end 80s, AI research was really hit very hard, because all these promises that were made and the expectations that actually were nurtured with expert systems couldn't be met. So this led to the so-called AI winter. The subsymbolic approaches remained very vague. It was not really clear what they can achieve and how they will be brought to work. Speech research didn't make much progress. Language understanding remained very difficult. We had specific hardware to actually execute the Lisp language, so-called Lisp machines. This market collapsed. Expert systems did not scale, and they could not handle contradictory knowledge and beliefs, so they could not really survive in practice. And Japan those days had a very ambitious so-called fifth generation computer systems program, but it never really worked. So they wanted to develop concurrent logic programming on special hardware to reach a layer hardware foundation for AI, and this also did not lead anywhere. The 90s were marked by, nevertheless, continuous progress on all these AI algorithms. People didn't make bold promises anymore. They were much more reluctant, looked more at the limitations of their algorithms, but still tried to push the boundary. And with the emergence of the internet And of course, the large availability of data and the significant growth in computing power, we see now a revival of AI methods. I call this the data-driven AI, and I think it started in 2000. Also, the AI hype by itself was noted by people a decade later. So we've actually achieved significant progress in all AI subfields. These are characterized by a better understanding of the problems and their complexity. We see an increased mathematical sophistication of the methods. This has then led to scalable and very robust algorithms. We have well understood expressive and representation formalisms. We know when we can apply all these methods. And we also see that in particular, big IT companies have published very mature AI programming frameworks. These are not really specific AI languages. Rather, we use existing programming languages, but very interesting frameworks to make it easier, for example, to implement machine learning approaches in Python or other algorithms. We also see for the last decade AI services and solutions offered by major IT vendors. So key players are, for example, Amazon with the Amazon Web Services, Facebook PyTorch is something that is very popular, and of course Google's frameworks for learning with neural networks are very, very successful. So with this, let me end this second podcast, and we continue with current trends then in the third part.